talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabat Ahwai. The Yemeni army says it has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which is, by some accounts, the tourism and commercial hub of the Persian Gulf region, at least for now. The Yemeni army has warned foreign firms and investors to leave the UAE, as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. Will the UAE change track, or will it gamble its entire country to continue a losing war along with its big brother, Saudi Arabia? Just one of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight.
A war Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched on Yemen has taken a new twist, with the Yemeni army now opening a new front, the United Arab Emirates. Last week, the Yemeni army fired a number of missiles and drones into the heart of the UAE, usually an oasis of calm in the often volatile region. The Yemenis have done it again, targeting the UAE as well as Saudi Arabia as part of their retaliatory attacks on aggressors.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area.
The Sheikhdom claims it intercepted two ballistic missiles with no casualties on Monday, but it made no comment on any drone or missile attacks. Saudi Arabia has also confirmed some missiles hit south of the kingdom, but says some projectiles were intercepted. The Yemeni army is now warning firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. A journalist says the Yemeni army aims to hit the UAE where it hurts, the economy.
The UAE is a hub of international commerce and international trade. And in fact, without international global finance, this country would not prosper, would barely even, you know, exist as a modern state.
The strikes are part of reprisal attacks over nearly 7-year-long deadly Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis. Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strike by Saudi war machines that claimed dozens of more innocent lives, including children. The United Arab Emirates is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the war. It remained involved in the aggression despite announcing its withdrawal from the alliance 2 years ago. Now the question is, isn't it time for the Emiratis to think before playing into the hands of Saudis? A political commentator says the recent attacks are a clear message for Sheikhdom to avoid playing its destructive role.
The role of United Arab Emirates in Yemen has been so bad and so damaging and so destructive against Yemeni civilians. And I think that United Arab Emirates, they should be really careful to target Yemen from now on.
Relentless bombing campaigns against Yemen and the blockade of the country have so far proved futile for Riyadh and his allies to achieve their intended goals. It remains to be seen if Emirati leaders will change their course of actions and start partnering with Saudi Arabia in its long-running war on the Arab world's poorest country and continue to face the consequences of their aggression.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Professor of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Daniel Kovalik, joining us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is an activist and political commentator, Leif Marouf, who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Leif Marouf, I'm going to start with you. And let's take a look in your eyes, the strength that the Yemeni army is displaying. As Yahya Sari, the spokesman for the Yemeni army, said, ballistic missiles were fired at the Al Dhafra air base in Abu Dhabi, which is also used by the U.S. It also targeted other sensitive areas, based on the spokesperson of what he said. He said they had also launched drones towards Dubai. At the same time, the Yemeni army launched attacks against Saudi Arabia. So tell us about the strength and the sheer power that the Yemeni army has, so we can get an overview of that.
Well, let's remember that just a few days before this retaliatory attack, the Saudi and Emirati forces bombarded Sa'da province in the north of Yemen and Hudaydah and Sana'a with huge bombs, destroying a prison, killing hundreds of people, using bunker busters to supposedly reach the stocks of missiles and drones that the Yemeni army has. And what do we have as a response? As expected, the Yemenis responded with hellfire and attacking military and economic sites in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi. So this shows us that the intelligence gathering capabilities of the Americans and their vessels in the Gulf is almost null. They were not able to hit any of the stocks of missiles and drones that the Yemeni army holds. And what we saw by these brazen attacks on multiple Saudi military bases in the south and the air base in the United Arab Emirates is that the air defenses that the Americans and the Israelis have sold to these vessels in the Gulf are useless. I mean, the videos that we watched of these missiles going up in the air in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and not hitting any target, and some of them even falling back down onto the ground on the civilians and inhabited areas of Dubai and Abu Dhabi, that shows you how number one, how great the work of the Yemeni army is and how irrelevant and useless the defensive strategies of both Saudi and Emirates are.
Sure. Now, taking a look, Daniel Kovalik, at the size of the UAE, what is it, about 83,000 square kilometers? The U.S. is by far a lot larger, and we can compare that to maybe a small state in the U.S. Given that perspective, we are looking now at a game changer. The Yemeni army spokesperson has said, we advise foreign companies and investors in the UAE to leave as it has become unsafe, and basically threatening the investment that's happening there, the tourism that happens in that country. Why is the UAE taking a gamble that could cost it the entire country?
Well, we'll see how long they do take that gamble. I think they're taking it for now because they do have pressure on them from the U.S., from Great Britain, Saudi Arabia, Israel, to continue this war against Yemen, which all the parties I just mentioned have some role in. And so the UAE being...
Okay, expand on that if you can. I'm sorry to jump in. When you say they have a role, are they dictating to the UAE what to do? Is that what you mean?
That is my sense, certainly. I don't think the UAE has the capacity to wage any type of war on its own, and probably would not, but that it is getting pressure from these other countries that have a huge say in the UAE because of the financial interests that they have in that country. And so the UAE essentially is acting like a client state here, and that is why they're putting everything, as you say, on the line here. But again, how long they can or will do that is unclear.
Well, Leif Marouf, then, I'm trying to figure out the thinking here. If I'm sitting in the palace there in the UAE or Dubai or Abu Dhabi, wherever they have it, do they understand that the UAE could become collateral damage of this war? Because again, it's so small, it's within range. The Yemeni army is warning it now, it seems, every few days, withdraw from this war. And it's hitting the UAE deep. And yet they're continuing with this. So are the financial returns worth it in their minds to be pressured by the U.S., by Israel, in this case, and maybe Saudi Arabia also?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously these states are vassals, but more so when we talk about the UAE, because the UAE is not a country that existed before British colonialism. You know, the area used to be called the Desert of Oman or the Desert of Bahrain prior to the British colonization and the creation of this state. This country is 10 million inhabitants, but 9 million of them are non-citizens that are foreign workers, which means this is the economy of the country is exaggerated and is dependent on the foreign workers that are servicing international businesses. And this, you know, adds another layer, which shows that the United Arab Emirates is actually one of the few countries in the world that are directly controlled by corporations. When we talk about 9 out of 10 people are foreign workers, who are they working for? They're working for foreign international companies. And those international companies are the ones that make the decisions. And as we see, the Yemenis have done a very smart thing addressing these corporations that actually control the country and saying to them that this state will statelet, as actually the spokesperson of Yemen called it, this statelet will not be a safe business place. And if this continues, and they will lose their money. And many of these foreign workers, if actual, you know, the United Arab Emirates it turns into a war zone, they will pack up and leave. Therefore, this country not only is built out of glass towers, but the whole economy of it, the whole existence of it, is a glass tower situation that will collapse very easily. And unfortunate for the Emiratis, because they are not sovereign and they can't take these decisions. The decision will come from these corporations.
No, indeed. Well, in the U.S., there are Democrats, Daniel Kovalik, that are against this war. As a matter of fact, when Joe Biden was running during his campaign trail, he said that he's going to end the war. But recently, Democrats came out and wanted clarification, as they called it, from the U.S. president. They said this is vague, what is happening. Congressman Peter DeFazio, one of them, that said that Washington needs to offer more than just vague declarations. I don't quite get what is vague about this when Biden just weeks ago approved over $600 million in arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
There is nothing vague about it. I mean, to put a finer point on it, Biden lied when he said he was going to stop supporting the war. He knew that the war was unpopular amongst liberals who at least understood what was happening there. This is, as you mentioned at the outset, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and it is being created by this unprovoked war. And it has to be pointed out, this was not started by Saudi Arabia with the help of President Obama, it must be said, because it was attacked by Yemen. It was started because Riyadh did not like the government in Yemen. That is not a basis under international law to start a war, and it has created the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. And so again, liberals who are paying any attention have been opposed to this war. Biden knew that, so he simply said, I'm going to stop supporting it, and then he went on and continued supporting it. That's what's happened. There's nothing vague about it. He lied, and very few people have held him to account. And even now, there's very few Democrats who are putting pressure on him to stop this.
Let's talk about the unspoken of this war, Leif Maruf. One of the things that people don't realize, and that is a particular flashpoint that has become known as the port of Balhaf, from what I'm reading here. This is basically a seaport. And the UAE, when it began this war, has actually taken this seaport over, this area. So much so that it ousted the governor, and then the locals there are obviously very disturbed by the fact that the UAE has taken over their sovereignty of this particular area. This was once an economic lifeline for Yemenis, but now it's basically a military camp for the UAE. These are the unspoken of the war. And it's a seaport, and it seems like the UAE is very interested in these port towns. Doesn't that show that there's a violation of the sovereignty taking place, not reported, obviously?
Yes, and it goes more than that. You know, I'm glad you mentioned this story, because the Yemeni army and resistance bombed the main UAE base in this port city and leveled to the ground the base, killing hundreds of militias that belong to the UAE and some sergeants and officers that are from the UAE military. And as you know, they were so, you know, angry that they chased away the governor, who is one of their men, you know, so they blamed him for their own failures. And the story here with this port and many of the other ports of Yemen and many of the islands of Yemen, including Socotra and the islands on the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, actually connects to the Zionist colony. And today, in the statements of the Yemeni officials, they said that they have some evidence to direct involvement of the Zionists in the attacks that just occurred a few days ago by the Saudis and Emiratis on Yemen, with that huge massacre of over 300 civilians killed, and said that they are investigating, and if they have full, you know, confidence in this evidence, they will be retaliating against the Zionist colony. And if you read the Israeli media today, they are really worried, because the ballistic missiles and drones of Yemen that reached all the way to Abu Dhabi and Dubai and could reach very easily Eilat and the Naqab Desert, and can retaliate on those attacks, mm-hmm. if proven by that the Zionists were involved. So this is now going to escalate further than the Americans could ever imagine.
Daniel Kobalik, it shouldn't be really that surprising when the attack took place by the Yemeni army the last time around on the UAE. The Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett came out and said, "We stand ready to offer you security and intelligence support in order to help you protect your citizens from similar attacks." Are we looking at Israeli direct involvement, as our guest there said, and then for them to also then become a target?
Well, I certainly would not be surprised if there is a direct level of involvement by Israel. Israel is very opposed to the Houthi government in Yemen. It sees it as a threat to its own regional influence, and so I have no doubt that it has a lot of involvement. We probably don't know how much in this war. And yes, if it's proven that it had some direct involvement in this war crime, and that's what it was, a war crime that killed at least 100 civilians, including children, then it is certain that Yemen will retaliate against Israel, and it has a right to do that. You know, there's this bizarre almost assumption that the U.S. and Israel are the only countries in the world that have a right to self-defense, and everyone just has to take a beating. And the Houthis are saying, no, that's not the case. We have the right to defend ourselves. And I think we're going to see more out of the Houthis that are going to demonstrate that.
So to conclude here, Leif Maruf, I'm looking at the drawing board, and I'm saying, okay, the UAE has become a victim. Saudi Arabia, obviously, is in danger. You have, Israel's involvement. Israel becomes a target. You have how the regional dynamics have now changed, which could engulf maybe the Persian Gulf region, because you're looking at potential risk to danger, for example, to energy pipelines, production facilities, stock market to have somewhat dipped in Abu Dhabi and also other stock markets in the region. U.S. citizens warning UAE, their citizens in the UAE to leave or to be very cautious. I should say, I'll rephrase that. All of the downside of this whole thing outweighs the participation of the bombing campaign that's killing civilians. Why do they continue this war?
Because the Americans lost the war in Syria, lost the war in Iraq, lost the war in Gaza and in Palestine and in Lebanon, and now they only see as the Yemenis as a punching bag to continue proving that they are virile. And what's actually the Yemenis are doing is crushing their you know, they're crushing them hard openly, you know. And what the danger is for all of us in Western Asia here living is that we know that the Americans and their vessels act in coordination on all fronts. We also know that the resistance axis has, since the war on Palestine last year, have said they are also coordinating all their activities. So we don't know an attack on Yemen that is responded to you know, in Palestine, how it could, you know, roll out in the whole region. We don't also know even if there's a trigger in Iraq or Syria or in Lebanon that could trigger a regional, confrontation. And this is where the danger is, lies between the, you know, supremacy of the Zionists and the Americans, and the reality on the ground that they can't apply this supremacy anymore.
Uh-huh.
And because of this anger that they have, we could, you know, see ourselves in a regional war at any moment.
Indeed. Okay, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you for your contribution, Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Daniel Kabalik, a pleasure. Thank you for your input. Professor of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, who spoke to us from Pittsburgh. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tafwe, entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
مقایسه گاهی سعودی است، گاهی نزولی است و گاهی همسد.
Dear brothers and sisters, we have three types of comparison. They are called ascending, descending, and parallel. Now, ascending comparison in financial matters might cause anxiety and unrest for a person, whereas in descending comparison can cause internal peace for someone. As it is related by Salman al-Farsi, who narrated from Prophet Muhammad, stating, O Salman, try to have a descending comparison in your worldly affairs. This statement by Prophet Muhammad means that we never compare our financial affairs with people who are higher than us, because we might not be able to reach them and become anxious and sometimes jealous inside.
سوره قصص آیه 79 خوب دقت کنید.
In Surah Qasas, Ayah 79, we read, So he emerged before his people in his finery. Those who desired the life of the world said, We wish we had like what Korah has been given. Indeed, he is greatly fortunate. Based on this ayah, the lovers of this world made an ascending comparison between themselves and Korah and wished to be as fortunate as Korah was in terms of wealth. This is why they felt unfortunate about themselves, since their comparison was based on worldly desires. Therefore, comparing oneself with a person who is richer and wealthier than you only causes unrest inside your soul. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Monday, ministers from the EU's 27 member states gathered in Brussels to discuss growing tensions with Russia. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken joined them via video link. The West warns the toughest ever financial sanctions against Moscow will be unveiled if Ukraine is invaded.
It will be a quick and determined action with a strong unity, not only within the European Union, but also internationally.
Moscow accuses the West of unnecessary provocation. This as the US ponders deploying thousands of troops and military hardware to Eastern Europe. Many security analysts say the Kremlin is fully justified in demanding that NATO halts its expansion around Russia. There's concern that if a new sanctions package is unveiled, Moscow could turn off the EU's essential gas supplies. Speaking to us online, the European Policy Centre's Amanda Paul expressed scepticism regarding threats from Brussels.
There may not be a strong desire from some member states to have very tough sanctions that could actually have economic losses for those member states themselves.
Also on Monday, the EU announced €1.2 billion to support Ukraine.
This package will help Ukraine now to address its financing needs due to the conflict. We count on the Council and the European Parliament to adopt this emergency macrofinancial assistance as soon as possible.
Von der Leyen says a further €6 billion is in the pipeline for Kiev. This is in addition to the €17 billion already sent by the EU to Ukraine since 2014. Critics are incensed because the bloc's own agency, the European Court of Auditors, says Ukraine is extremely corrupt. Negotiations between the West and Russia will continue at various political levels in the coming days. Analysts say the only option is for both sides to give ground, because the alternative is unthinkable. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A moment of celebration for supporters of Julian Assange. Another chance at preventing his extradition to the United States on espionage charges. His partner, with whom he has two young children, shared the good news.
The High Court certified that we had raised point of law of general public importance, and that the Supreme Court has good grounds to hear this appeal. The situation now is that the Supreme Court has to decide whether it will hear the appeal. But make no mistake, we won today in court.
Hey!
In December last year, judges in this court decided there was no ground to believe Assange was a clear suicide risk, which an earlier ruling had found to be the case. Also last year, U.S. government lawyers gave assurances Assange would not be treated inhumanely if extradited. Assurances Assange's legal team and supporters find hard to believe.
The assurances are really misnamed. They aren't assurances and they aren't guarantees, because contained within the very same document is the provision that the United States can withdraw them at any time.
The U.S. wants Assange to face trial over the release in 2010 of thousands of classified military documents relating to U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Rights groups have denounced his treatment and described it as a serious threat to press freedom.
It's an extremely worrying case, and it will have huge implications for journalism and press freedom internationally. If the U.S. is successful in extraditing Julian Assange and prosecuting him under the Espionage Act there, he would be the first publisher prosecuted under that law, which lacks a public interest defense. That same precedent could be applied to any publisher, any journalist, any source. So we would see likely a very serious chilling effect, in particular on national security reporting around the world, any type of journalism that deals with leaked information. So this is one reason we highlight this case is, of course, Julian Assange's own rights are at stake here, but what this means for journalism around the world is extremely alarming.
Today's decision, a partial victory for the campaign to release Julian Assange. It will now be up to the Supreme Court to decide if it will hear Assange's case. But until that happens, his supporters say the fight to win his freedom is on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in returned from visits to the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt Saturday. In Dubai, South Korean companies inked the country's largest ever single-arm sale, a reported $3.5 billion missile defense system for the UAE. Some South Korean activists worry about the human cost.
South Korea's decision to export weapons rather than trying to help to peacefully resolve the conflict raises a voice of concern over the export, because it generates further tension, conflict, and division in the region.
South Korea's also increased weapons exports to Saudi Arabia. Chung Uk-shik has tracked South Korea's weapons sales for 20 years.
The U.S. military industrial complex is always mentioned and criticized, but one can question whether South Korea will also gradually develop a military industrial complex through continued weapons exports.
South Korea has steadily increased its arms development over the past two decades and now ranks as the world's sixth leading weapons exporter. South Korean companies have also diversified their offerings to include tanks, missiles, and even controversial cluster bombs. Saudi Arabia has deployed South Korea's Raybolt anti-tank guided missile to Yemen, where the conflict features more advanced weapons. Riyadh's recent airstrikes generated mass demonstrations there, but little interest in South Korea. Activist Chung worries how arms exports will affect diplomacy.
The government, media, and the South Korean people need to reflect about on how our appeals for support for peace on the Korean Peninsula will be considered when South Korea is increasing weapons exports under the rationale of profit and income.
President Moon Jae-in's trip comes as his single term is set to wrap up in May. However, South Korea's arms industry enjoys broad bipartisan political support. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to highlight the plight of the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails amid the spread of COVID-19 infection. According to Wa'ad Institute for Palestinian Prisoners Affairs, the virus is significantly on the rise among the inmates, infecting hundreds of Palestinian prisoners who have caught the new coronavirus. The statement indicates that more than 100 of the Palestinians have tested positive. These Palestinians say the spread of the virus among Palestinian inmates is the result of Israel's intentional policy of medical negligence.
Israeli regimes keeps adopting inhumane measures against our prisoners, depriving them of their basic rights. There is a clear intentional medical negligence by Israeli regime that is aimed on putting more pressure on our inmates.
The Palestinians called on the international community and the Red Cross to provide the required medical care for Palestinian inmates and stop the spread of the pandemic in Israeli jails. Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip say they hold the Israeli regime fully responsible for the lives of the Palestinian inmates, stressing that the prisoners' issue is a top priority and they won't remain silent over these Israeli violations. According to Palestinian authorities, 5,000 Palestinians, including women and minors, are currently held in Israeli jails, with many of them under the so-called administrative policy, which enables Israel to hold them in jail with no charge. The total number of infections among Palestinian inmates has risen rapidly, according to the Prisoners Club statement. Palestinians are calling on the international community to make an action, adding this intentional medical negligence amounts to complicity in the Israeli crimes practiced against Palestinians inside jails. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 agreement that promised sanctions relief for certain caps on Iran's nuclear program are intensifying the process of drafting a revived deal. Delegates from Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU have now adopted a new format for discussions, meeting together in one room to focus on the Iranian demands for verified and effective removal of US sanctions and guarantees Washington will not withdraw from the agreement in future or reimpose sanctions. This while expert-level talks continue in other rooms on Iranian nuclear commitments and the sequencing of steps that need to be taken for Iran and the US to go back to full compliance. European and American officials have been raising concerns about the amount of time left to reach a conclusion, with some diplomats suggesting they only have weeks, and other sources citing early February as an unofficial deadline.
If Western countries give the necessary assurances, the necessary guarantees, and if they remove the sanctions, then that will be enough. But if they want to drag their feet, if they want to be slow about it, then the negotiations will be slow. For Iran, that is the issue. The dates, the length of the negotiations, whether it takes a week or a month or a year, that's irrelevant. Because the Iranians know if they get a bad deal, there's nothing that they're going to be able to do about it. So they have to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans are unable to cheat them at the negotiating table.
Sources close to the talks say the negotiations are progressing at a normal pace. To claim that the talks have stagnated is unfair, they say, because resolving the outstanding issues requires further discussions given the complexities of the problems. Omar Lezki, Vienna.
Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation.
That was how Joe Biden laid out the path for his presidency during his inaugural address on the 6th of January, 2021. It came after supporters of his predecessor, Donald Trump, raided the Capitol Hill in a deadly unrest because the former president refused to accept defeat and claimed an election fraud. Speaking exactly a year after he took office, Biden said he had not overpromised in his inaugural speech on what he could achieve. Yet a review of the status quo in the United States tells a different story. Back in October, a poll showed that 41% of Biden's supporters and 52% of those who voted for Trump want Republican and Democratic-led states to secede and form two new countries. The divide continues to define the American society and politics to the day. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate blocked Biden's key legislation to protect voting rights for African Americans and other minorities, especially in the Republican-controlled states. Democrats pushed the legislation amid restrictive voting in some Republican-led states, which Democrats see as a slow-motion coup to retake the White House in the next presidential election. Republican-led states also moved to restrict teaching critical race theory in schools. That's teaching students on the history of slavery and racism and how they shaped U.S. institutions and policy to ensure the dominance of white people. One such ban did actually become law in Mississippi on Saturday. The debates hark back to racial tensions triggered by the fatal shootings of African Americans, which have ignited some of the most serious social unrest of the modern times in the U.S. A case in point in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in November. The not guilty verdict in the trial was an affront to those who saw the teenager as a murderer, butting into a protest against racial injustice and killing two demonstrators. The ruling, however, was a gift to those who saw Rittenhouse as a right-wing patriot. Over the past year, the U.S. has also seen huge divisions among Republican and Democratic voters over such issues as the conservative-led push to restrict constitutional abortion rights, obligatory vaccination against the coronavirus, and even Democratic-led attempts to curb access to guns. These have also been key areas of political point scoring among Republicans and Democrats.
One thing I hadn't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for?
Deep divides have always been there among Democrats and Republicans and their supporters, but the Capitol Hill insurrection seems to have radicalized things. Trump continues to enjoy backing from Republicans after he triggered the insurrection by the claim that Biden won the election by vote rigging. This has polarized American politics more than ever before. The insurrection has also sent reverberations through the American society, dividing people across political and racial lines.
Things started out peacefully on Sunday as an estimated 50,000 protesters took to the streets of Brussels in opposition to COVID-19 vaccines and the requirement to show certificates in order, for example, to eat in a restaurant or travel. However, things turned ugly as police were attacked by some of the demonstrators. Tear gas and water cannon were then deployed to break up the crowds. Prior to the clashes, we spoke to some of those in attendance.
Do you think the vaccine is dangerous?
I'm sure that it is dangerous.
There's no problem with the vaccine. If you want a vaccine, okay. But if you don't want it, please leave us be.
The European United Group, which organized the event, claims it's not anti-vax, but it certainly didn't sound that way.
To Mr. Bill Gates, we say, you might mean well with your vaccines, but we don't need them.
The data is indisputable. Lockdowns followed by vaccines, when they became available, are measures that have saved millions of lives. But some insist the inoculation drive is going too far.
Children shouldn't be vaccinated. We have an immune system. We shouldn't do this. This is an experiment.
For others, the booster campaign is an issue.
I had my basic vaccines because I work in healthcare, but booster after booster, it's not okay.
The 27-nation EU has a population of just under 450 million. 20% of adults are refusing to take a COVID-19 vaccine.
That is clearly a very significant minority. Epidemiologists say if they did take the jab, most of the restrictions these people are protesting against could be lifted much more quickly.
Anarchists managed to reach the offices of EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Police are promising arrests in the coming days. The protesters are promising they will be back out on the streets here again next Sunday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PAMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
On behalf of the youth concerning justice for the world, a new paradigm response to the leader's letters to the youth in Western countries. The title of a 90-page book authored by retired British binary economics professor Rodney Shakespeare.
The book addresses the main issues for the world today. For example, there's massive inequality. There are preposterous accumulations of wealth. There's no justice. The exploitation of justice is in fact in the example that Iran is capable of giving as Iran develops the resistance economy.
The book, to be translated into multiple languages, picks up on two open letters penned by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the wake of a rise in terrorist attacks in 2015, among them the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, which fueled Islamophobia in the West.
Islamophobia started immediately after Islamic Revolution in Iran. Although it surprised many in the world, they didn't have any strategy or plan, following which several false flag operations were created to damage the image of Islam. And it was necessary then to address the issue.
In those letters circulated widely online, Ayatollah Khamenei urged Western youth not to believe prejudiced portrayals of Islam by Western mainstream media or people in power, but to keep an open mind and judge the Muslim faith fairly.
The Muslim community are kind and peaceful people, and it's ridiculous to prejudice a whole huge community just because of the actions of one or two people that aren't following the faith that so many of them believe in, and that it's unfair.
More than anything, Professor Shakespeare's book is an economist's view on some of the biggest issues facing humanity, from the vices of capitalism to climate injustice, and whether Islam is the answer. The final chapter envisages the makeup of a true Islamic economy.
At the heart of an Islamic economy is the use of money, which is genuinely interest-free, not pretend. And when you understand that, when you understand that money is today created out of nothing, the way is open, a massive supply of interest-free money, as long as it goes out and is repaid and cancelled, and you can use it in countless ways.
In a world where Islamophobia, as well as economic and other injustices, are on the rise, Professor Shakespeare argues there is a need for a new reset, a paradigm shift. And it's exactly that paradigm shift, he proclaims, that terrifies the West. Said Puriza, London.
In the limelight.
Dozens of women journalists and human rights defenders in Bahrain and Jordan have had their phones hacked using NSO Group's Pegasus spyware, according to a report by Frontline Defenders and Access Now. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Anna Maria Silic Ryder. This article is titled Pegasus Spyware Used Against Dozens of Activist Women in West Asia. Stay tuned for more. Dozens of women journalists and human rights defenders in Bahrain and Jordan have had their phones hacked using NSO Group's Pegasus spyware, according to a report by Frontline Defenders and Access Now. The report adds to a growing public record of Pegasus misuse globally, including against dissidents, reporters, diplomats, and members of the clergy. It also threatens to increase pressure on the Zionist regime-based NSO Group, which in November was placed on a U.S. trade blacklist. When governments surveil women, they are working to destroy them, wrote Marwa Fatfa, the West Asia region and North Africa policy manager at Access Now, in a statement accompanying the report. Surveillance is an act of violence. It is about exerting power on every aspect of a woman's life through intimidation, harassment, and character assassination. The NSO Group and its clients are all responsible and must be publicly exposed and disgraced. NSO Group was placed on the trade blacklist after a consortium of journalists working with the French non-profit Forbidden Stories reported multiple cases in which journalists and activists appear to have been targeted by foreign governments using the spyware. The same month, researchers from Amnesty International and the University of Toronto Citizen Lab said they found Pegasus on the phones of six Palestinian human rights activists. Last week, another Citizen Lab report found that dozens of Salvadoran human rights activists' phones had been hacked using Pegasus. Pegasus is breathtaking in its ability to take complete control of a device without detection and is often referred to as military-grade spyware. Researchers have said that it can access every message the subject has sent and received, including from encrypted messaging services. It can also access the camera and microphone, record the screen, and monitor the subject's location via GPS. Apple sued NSO Group in November, trying to stop the company's software from compromising its operating systems. That followed a similar suit from Facebook in 2019, alleging that the company was hacking the social media giant's WhatsApp messaging service. NSO Group did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the new report. But earlier this week, in the wake of the El Salvador research, it said that it only grants licenses to government intelligence and law enforcement agencies following a process of investigation and licensing by the